This is the continuation of session one.
The main thing is what you're intending, and that's what plants the karma in your mind. So let's say that all of your life is a ripening of karma. How does it ripen? Okay, that's a very interesting thing. What is the nature of it ripening? Are you really just looking at another part of your mind? As these forms, as these apparitions come and go, you know, are you just part of my mind? You know, Madhyamika says no. Madhyamika says there is data. There is external data. You know, when I look at someone in this room, sorry to use you an example. I see hair. I see a certain shape. I see patches of flesh color. I see patches of brown color. I see the round corner of an eye. And these two holes here, and Madhyamika says, yeah, you do see those things. You are seeing data. There is data being presented to you, and then your mind interprets it. You know, your mind pieces it together, and how it pieces it together is very much dependent on what?
Karma.
On your karma, and it makes nice sense. So I am getting. There is data out there. No one can deny that there's certain shapes and there's certain colors and there's certain patches of this color and patches of another color. And my mind is taking that data and it's imposing on it a certain object. I'm identifying him. I see a person sitting in a class. From that data of all these different shapes and colors, I get all these disparate sense data, and then I'm interpreting it, and mentally I'm creating an image of a person. You know, I'm imposing on that data the image of a human being sitting in front of me. That is kune takpa. That is imputation. That's what the Madhyamika is always talking about of imputing reality. Okay. Does it mean there's no colors and shapes out there? No. They do exist. But I take those colors and shapes and in my own mind I make an ideal image out of them. I image them. And I image it into a person, a student sitting in a class. That image exists where? Where does the image exist? That's in the mind. The imputation, meaning the perfection of an image from a few... Why, when I see a few angles and colors and different shapes, why do I image that as a person? You know, is that self-existent in the sense of... Is that necessarily the way it had to be? You know, could I take those same data and make something else out of them? I see a rather pleasant person sitting in a Dharma class. You know, I image it that way. But could someone else image it a different way? Absolutely. I mean, someone who doesn't like him could come in and say, "Oh, you don't know. He's so bad." You know, I said, "No, he looks like an okay guy." You know, and they say, "No, no, no." They're imaging him in a different way. They're taking the same data. They see the same colors and shapes, but in their own mind, they see something else. And if a bug walks in, if a bug's crawling across the carpet and looks up at these same colors and shapes. I mean, it looks like Mount Rushmore, you know. I mean, to him, it's just a huge, dangerous thing, you know, that might step on me. You know, to him, it's the same. He's looking at the same data. He's also looking at colors and shapes. The data exists, but he's imaging it in a totally different way. He's seeing, that bug is seeing something incredibly dangerous and huge and life-threatening. Who's right, me or the bug? Duh. Okay. Are you saying that the bug doesn't have a correct perception, valid perception, and I don't have a valid perception?
That's what I'm saying.
Duh. Then I say, so you're not a person.
Duh. I'm not a person. I seem to be a person.
So I don't perceive you as a person.
I can't say what.
Suppose I do. Okay.
Okay, then suppose you perceive
me as a person. So I perceive you as a person, right? So you're a person, right?
In your perception.
Okay, so you're a person.
In your perception.
am I drunk, crazy, on LSD, or anything else that you can tell?
You're a mad monk.
I know. No, but do I have... Is there anything which might affect my perception in a standard way?
Not that I can tell.
Yeah, not that you can tell. I mean, this is what we call pramana. It's called sema. Pramana means normal, unaffected, unscrewed up, un-LSD, you know, undrunk, no seeing purple elephants or anything. Just a normal person's perception of you. Do I have a sema about you?
You what?
Am I having a pramana about you? See, I mean, I do. Apparently I'm having. Okay? You can say apparently I'm having, okay? Therefore you exist. Person exists. Therefore you are a person.
From what seems to be your perception.
Yeah, because I'm having a perception which is not messed up by some kind of drug or something else. Because I'm having a normal perception of you as a person, you must be a person.
From what seems to be your
perception. No, assume I have.
Okay,
a priori.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, right. Because seme mipa yupe tseni. Say it. Seme.
Seme.
Mikpa.
Yupe.
Tseni.
Seme,
seme,
mikpa,
yupe,
seni.
Seme mikpa means proceed with a normal, unmessed up perception, called a pramana. Seme mikpa means I perceive you with that. Yupe seni, yupe means what?
Existence.
That's the definition of existence in Buddhism. Okay. How do you know something exists? Because I'm not crazy, I'm not drunk, nothing else going on, and I see it. So it exists. Okay, and that's the very definition of existence in Buddhism. So you must be a person. Can we agree? I'm having a pramana that you are a person. The definition of you being a person is for me to have a pramana of you as a person. Therefore, you're a person. Right?
I guess so.
That's not true, because you... because you are a huge, mountainous, life-threatening mass that might step on me shortly. Right?
Could be.
No, I mean to a bug.
To a bug.
To a roach. Okay. Is he having a sim or not?
I can't say, because that bug is appearing in my mind as a perception from this point of view.
Yeah. And no, but I mean, if he's just a normal bug and he's looking at you, and don't get too deep here.
I'm not distorting the whole thing.
No, but we can assume that he's pretty scared. If someone's moving towards the bug and he sees a huge thing that blocks out half his sky,
right,
and it's coming down on him. And
okay, from this point of view that you've given me, I'll say yes.
Good, good. Okay. So, you're both a normal, nice human being sitting here, and a huge, threatening, mountainous mass. You're both of those things.
At least.
So, yeah. So they're both correct. According to Buddhism, they're both correct. They're both valid perceptions. Yeah.
Perception of physical reality and perception of mental reality.
Not at all. Not at all. I wasn't going to get into it yet, but since you asked.
But, I mean, as far as seeing him, whether the ant sees or you see it, physically the same thing is being seen, right? So physically the same five senses are seeing precisely the same thing, but I think the mental perception of it is what is different. Or are these two interconnected in some way?
Well, I think what I do, I was going to say this for tomorrow, but we'll go into it now. We got a little time. I'll set you up for tomorrow, okay? And it's the next reading, and I'll give it to you when we let out tonight. How's that? There's three readings, and that one you can read also. There's a study of something. Oh, by the way, so let me just cover one more thing. So the bug is seeing you one way, which is valid. And I'm taking that same data and organizing it in a different way, which is also valid. So one person can be to two different people, or two different beings, something totally different, and that's not contradictory. He can be both at the same time. The punchline here, and that actually that's the end of the first part, is if all he is for me is an organization of the data, you know, if what I see is taking certain colors and shapes and organizing them mentally into an image of a person sitting there, is that something voluntary or not? That's a question. Could I have chosen to see you as a tantric deity? Could I have chosen to see you as a demon?
Yes.
Voluntarily. Can I at this moment in my life say, I decide that from 3:30, everyone in this room is an angel, a true angel. I'm surrounded by holy beings. Can I, by my deciding that, will I perceive that? Will I organize the data in that way? I mean, could I? That's another question. But can I voluntarily decide that from this moment on, every time the dentist hits my nerve, drilling my tooth, I choose to perceive it as flowers being thrown at me?
Not in terms of karma as we've discussed it so far.
Absolutely not. That's the rub. That's the rub. Okay, it is artificial reality, you know. It is my own organizing and imaging the data that I receive through my senses, you know, in a certain way. But the last thing is voluntary, you know. I'm being forced by that karma. That karma is absolutely in control. I may even understand that you are just my construct. You know, even as I perceive you, I may very well understand that I'm just interpreting data a certain way. Mm-hmm. But I can't change it by will. Cannot. You know, that's the nature of suffering. That's the essence of suffering. That's why karma makes you suffer. It forces you, those perceptions on you. We would all like to be in paradise in this room right now. I mean, all of us would like not to be getting older. I'd like to be not having this headache, you know. I can't, it's not a willpower, you know, it's not a matter of my will, you know. I have to, there has to be, it's being forced upon me. I'm taking the same sense data, you know. If I were pure, you know, if Jesus walked in this room, and his mind was totally pure and he had no past karmas that were negative, he would actually be experiencing this room as a room full of as he'd be in heaven. He would literally be in heaven, in paradise, you know. And I can't be in a paradise. I'm in a room of people like, you know, that appear to me like me, who is getting old and has all these bad thoughts and, you know, does all these mixed up, you know, some good things, some bad things. I'm perceiving this same room as that. But is it out of the question for someone who didn't have those problems to perceive it as something totally different? I mean, that's the case. I mean, but he or she would be forced to see that. Why? What's forcing Jesus to see it as heaven in this room?
Past karma.
His karma. It's interesting. You know, if you could fool around with the karma, you know, if you could find some way to mess around with the workings of karma, short-circuit the bad ones and enhance the good ones to an ultimate extent, then you wouldn't be in a room with normal people anymore. You would be forced to perceive that same data. That same data, your own mind would be forcing you to see it as something else. And you would, by the way, you would know it, and you'd be enjoying it. And you'd be, what do you call it, perpetuating it constantly. You know, you would keep doing the things that you have to do to keep it going. And that is what it is to reach paradise. We'll get to that tomorrow. But we'll do some questions maybe. But anyway, that's the idea of one object being perceived in different ways, and not willingly, not voluntarily, but it's forced on you by your karma. Yeah.
I have heard both ways about this, that it's useful to develop good karma and actually create good karma. It's just more karma, you still have to clean up.
Right.
So I was wondering if you could speak about that a little bit. And when you were saying this, I was also wondering, is there a certain place where you get to where there's lack of karma, where you actually can choose to see it any way you want? So that you could be able to put on the perception that I have to see the world through my eyes temporarily, just to understand that.
Mm-hmm. The Abhidharma and the other schools, they have two kinds of karma. Say sakche.
Sakche.
Sakche gille.
Sakche
gille. And then sakme gille.
Sakme
gille.
Sakme gille.
Pure karma and impure karma. Okay? Sakche gille means impure karma, and sakme gille is pure karma. Technically speaking, in Buddhism, karma is always dirty. I mean, karma is always something that's perpetuating samsara, you know. And in other words, if you do good karma, whether you do good karma or bad karma, if you do it with ignorance, it perpetuates suffering. Okay, and that's interesting. What it means is, if you think of it in terms of karma, any pleasant experience that you and I ever have, that we're even capable of, for example, having a good job, or having a close friend, or being healthy, or looking nice, or being intelligent, or understanding Dharma. All of those are a result of a good karma. All of them. And they're all suffering. All of them are suffering. Why? They must be connected with a painful ending. They are always connected. I leave out learning Dharma, okay? That's the one exception in the Abhidharma. Lama tope duce nam sakche. That's the only exception. But let's leave out that. Every other experience of a pleasant object that you and I can ever have in this life is suffering, because it's always attached to a dreadful ending. You know, it's the tail of the dog is always comes. Used to say that when we used to drink tequila when I was a kid. But anyway, it's always connected to a suffering at the end. You always get a suffering at the end. It must deteriorate. It must collapse. It must go bad. It must turn sour. Every pleasure that you and I are capable of must and always will end, and end in a bad way. You know, there's no relationship you can ever go into that will not eventually end, even if it's only by death eventually. There's nothing you can own that you won't eventually lose. There's no state of health or handsomeness or intelligence that you can have that won't eventually turn to ugliness or stupidity or senility if you live that long. We can't have anything nice. We can't. The nature of it is that it always deteriorates. Why? If it's a perception that's being forced on you, why? Those bokchaks wore out. We ran out of bokchaks. Those little guys ran out, okay? They always run out. You know, the bits that are making the picture move, you know, all those megabytes of stuff, they always wear out. By being alive, by being pretty, by being handsome, by being smart, you are using up the bokchaks for being that. And eventually they wear out. And then you're back to zero. Back to ground zero. We're always back to ground zero. They come and they go and we lose them. And that's samsara. That's dirty karma. That's sakche kile. Any karma you collect with ignorance is of that nature. So that's the answer to your first part of your question. That's true. It'll always be that way. So is it useless to collect good karma if it only perpetuates suffering? No, because you have to do it knowingly. You know, if you do it knowingly, you know, if you do it with understanding, with knowledge, then it becomes sakmekile. And that's pure karma. And what it means, the implication there is that you will know how to perpetuate it. It becomes fission, is it, or fusion? Self-perpetuating reaction. It's the holy grail of science. Is that you get more energy out than you put in.
Yeah.
You know, you put in 1 teaspoon of water and you get endless amounts of energy, and it creates more. That's the idea. If you understand, that's wisdom. That's the perfection of wisdom. If you understand what's going on, and you manipulate it the right way, you can, that's the whole point, is that you can reach paradise. And you can, and it will continue. And it will not, it won't act the way samsara acts, because you know what's causing it. You know how to create everything perfectly, and you just create it. Is it a creation? Yes. Is it artificial? Yes. Is it real? It's as real as everything else was, you know. It's being forced on you. You will be forced to experience paradise. I'm sorry. You know. You know. You will, your mind, your karma will force you to think you're in paradise. And thinking you're there and being there for Buddhism is the same thing. Because it was all just perception anyway. It was all just a projection anyway. And you're just controlling your projections. So the Buddha knows perfectly how to... He knows how to create the correct karmas, although they don't technically call it karma at that point. And he's perpetuating that perception. And it will always be like that. Yeah.
What about the idea that karma is expanding? You know, what you were showing is kind of like one for one.
It's not one for one. It's there's four rules of karma. There's four rules about how karma behaves. And one of them is that it always expands. It expands exponentially. And the books on karma say, why would you expect anything else out of a seed? Because mental seeds and physical seeds work the same way. And I always tell the story, she knows. You know the temple in New Jersey? It's got these huge oak trees around it. And it was built by Mongolians like 40 years ago. And one day the wind came real strong and it blew down the oak tree and it smashed the roof. And the Mongolians all came and they said, you get up there with a chainsaw and cut the branches off. You know, and I'm like, my knees were literally shaking like that. I couldn't stay up there. And I was trying to cut these limbs with the chainsaw, you know. And I looked out on the street and there was an acorn on the, in the middle of the asphalt, you know, sitting there on the asphalt. And I looked at it and I said, you know, if 50 years ago somebody had taken this acorn and thrown it out on the asphalt, I wouldn't be up here, you know. You know, and, you know, it came to my mind, you know, it came to my mind, you know. It's too late now, but if somebody had just thrown that acorn over there, you know, that would have been... none of this stuff would have happened. So, if you compare the mass of the acorn to the mass of the oak tree, I don't know what it is. I can't even imagine. It must be 20, 30, 40,000 to 1. I don't know. But they say karma acts the same way, you know. And that becomes a very dangerous... In Tibetan, they say Kepen Chembo. Kepen Chembo means big risk, big returns. You know, it's like a high-risk investment, you know. Any karma you do, if it's good, you're going to get incredible returns. Even a small karma, even a wimpy karma, is going to give tremendous returns. And but the same applies for the slightest bad thought you have at work. It becomes a very difficult thing. The more you understand about karma, the more scary it is. Because just a passing irritation at someone at work could have tremendous bad results. And the whole Vinaya section of the canon, 16,000 pages, is telling you, be careful with even the small bad thoughts, because they become huge oak trees later, you know.
And so you're talking about purifying it, like cutting that oak tree wide.
Yeah, it's. I don't think you can teach this thing without getting into that at the end, because it would be cruel, you know. You know, I think, you know, you know, you have to talk about that, because according to Hinayana, there's no such thing. According to the lower vehicle, you cannot purify them. Once you have planted a bokchak by seeing yourself doing something bad, you are stuck. It's going to give a consequence, and it will never, never be wiped out. Until it gives its consequence, it will never be wiped out. You cannot affect it. That's why they're so, you know, mindfulness is so important in Hinayana. Like, every second, just watching everything. Because if the slightest bad thought goes through your mind, you're going to have tremendous consequences. And then Mahayana says that's true, but you can also do certain practices to remove it. And once you study those practices, you understand why that seems, it makes sense. It's not like a morning after pill, okay? It really is something that you can do afterwards that removes most of that karma. But it's a very, it has to be followed very precisely or it doesn't work. And that we'll get into that tomorrow. That's purification tomorrow. Any other questions anybody have?
We could die tonight. You sure you don't want to tell us?
I know.
That would be your number.
I think we'll do it tomorrow. But there's a... I want to teach you a thing called chumbap. Say chumbap.
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 Chumbap is a very famous section of Chandrakirti's Madhyamika Avatara. Madhyamika Avatara is the ultimate book about emptiness. Its structure is that it follows the six perfections. It talks about giving, morality, and effort, and then the other perfections, patience. But the sixth chapter is 90% of the book. Okay, what's the sixth chapter? It's wisdom, okay, and it's teaching about emptiness. So, like in the monastery, when we study that, we do it for 2 or 3 years, and the first part I think you go through the first 5 perfections in about 3 weeks, and then the rest is all the perfection of wisdom, you know. So, inside of that chapter, there's a subject called chumbap. Chumbap means a waterfall or a stream, and it refers to the stream that a preta sees. What's a preta? Yida? They call hungry ghosts. I don't like the word ghost because it sounds like Casper, you know? I like to call them craving spirits because that's the nature of their lives. They're spirits in the sense that you cannot see them. I guess ghost is like that too. And Buddhism says that they exist around us. And Buddhism says you cannot see them if you're just a normal person. Buddhism also, by the way, says don't claim you can see them if you can't see them. And don't say they exist for sure if you can't see them. So, okay, we have to say that scripture says there's this thing called a preta. And that especially people who have been cheap in this life, who have been possessive with their things, are born as pretas. Like if you've been attached to your house, then it might be likely that after you die, you'd be born as a preta in that house. And maybe that's where haunted houses come from. I mean, seriously, you know, maybe there's some thing that people had some, I don't know. But if you've had some connection with that house and you're very attached to it and you didn't share it with anyone and you got angry whenever someone messed up the rugs and stuff, you'd be born as this kind of a spirit and you live in that house. And there's 36 kinds of pretas, and they all have some kind of suffering related to their stinginess. And typically they have huge stomachs and tiny, their throats are like needles or straws. And if they get anything, they have this karmic habit of wanting. And they want more food than they could ever eat. And if they find some food, then they try to stuff it down, and it won't go down at the rate that they need to be satisfied. In other words, they're just in this total state of never being satisfied. And that's their karma, is to live that way. Other kinds of pretas, supposedly they can never get anything to eat or drink, because the minute they walk up to something, like they say, if they saw a stream in a distance and they ran to the stream because they were hungry all the time, thirsty, that the minute they got there, the stream would turn into this disgusting pus and blood and vomit and something very repulsive. And they, you know, that's their karma. Their karma is that their perception of that liquid at that moment becomes the perception of vomit and blood and pus. So they have this, that's their karma. So chumbap, the subject chumbap in Madhyamika Avatara, they say, what if a preta and a human and a hla or a deva, what's a deva? Hla. They say God. You know, this is a really tough word to translate, and I get in big fights with my fellow translators, you know. There's two kinds of thoughts, okay? And there's two kinds of devas. One is an enlightened being. That's like a tantric thought. You know, like Chakrasambhara or all those beings that you see in the pictures, you know. These are thoughts. And they have beautiful bodies. They're like totally enlightened angels, okay? They have this... That they're called laws. But there's another kind of law, which is if you're very good in this life, you can take birth in this temporary paradise and everything there is going right and everything there is very beautiful. It's like, I don't know, Beverly Hills or something. And everything is, you know, flowers grow and it smells wonderful and the ground is soft like a pillow and made of lapis lazuli and nobody ever argues with anybody and everyone's happy and you're young all the time and you just spend yourself with the girl laws hang out with the boy laws and they have a good time. And everything is nice and everything is perfect. And then after a few million years, they say the last day of your life there, or maybe a week before you die, all the ha thing starts to go away. And you start to, for the first time you perspire. And for the first time you start to smell. And for the first time your breath smells bad. And for the first time wrinkles start to form on your face. And, you know, all these things start to happen for the first time. You start to get old, all in one day. And the other ha's, when they see you, they're just repulsed. They're shocked. And then you have this extra suffering that no one wants to be near you anymore. You know, they all run away and they put you in a corner somewhere. And they say the last day in the life of a Tha is worse than, you know, a whole human life spent bad because you've never had anything go wrong. And now in the last day, everything goes wrong. And you start to die, you start to feel bad, your stomach starts to get sick and all these things happen to you. And then you have this moments of prescience where you can see what's going to happen to you after you die. And normally the amount of megabytes that's required to maintain a world like that for a million years is extraordinary. I mean, you can imagine, if you believe what I said about karma, and it's all these simbas, all these twitches of the mind collectively going off, these bakchaks going off and making you see this world for thousands and thousands of years, the amount of energy required to maintain that perception is extraordinary. And you it's like burning up $100 bills, you know. And then it ends. And then what? You don't have any left. You use it all up. So what's your next birth? I mean, they say the next birth is always a very bad one because you've used up all the good bok choks and all you have left is the lousy ones. So from then on, you're going to be, your projection that's forced on you is going to be the one totally under control of the lousy bok choks, the horrible ones. So then you see yourself becoming a hell being. And that's the way it exists. But if you...
an unfavorable rebirth.
It is.
Inevitably.
It is. Bodhisattvas avoid it like the plague. The scripture says that. Bodhisattvas avoid those births like the plague. There's no place to go after that. And they can't get renunciation until the last day. And it's too late. You know, no human being... The books say we're very lucky because our life is a big mix of crap and nice things. You know, I mean, it's very lucky that our life is so mixed up with pleasure and torment, because at least we can think, you know, what's causing me to have torment, you know, and we can see pleasure. Pleasure's not bad in the sense that when you reach paradise, things will be like that. You know, I mean, in the back of your mind, you're working for that. You know, Buddhists have this thing that I should avoid pleasure, or it's bad if I'm having a good time, you know, or, you know, or a monk shouldn't see a good movie or something like that, you know. I mean, not like that. I mean, there's something about pleasure which is similar to what you're going to have in paradise, and that's absolutely why you come to Buddhism class. I mean, you want to get rid of the bad things, and you want to be in some kind of pleasant state. That's the whole thing. So, we can see the pleasure and imagine what it would be like to be in paradise. That's good. But we can also see suffering and wonder where it came from and study Dharma, go to Dharma class. So supposedly a human birth is the best for that. So the Chumbap in the Madhyamika Avatara says, what if Oh, by the way, that's why it's called Chumbam, the stream. It refers to the stream that a preta sees when they run up to get a drink after not having water for 6 months or so. And they lean down, and then suddenly the water becomes blood and pus and vomit and things like that. So it refers to that. What the whole scripture goes into is that if you have in a room, sitting around a table, a sa, a preta, and a human being, and you set a glass of water in the middle of them, what happens? What do they see? You know, what? Yeah, it's very beautiful. It's very interesting. I'll give you the reading before you go home tonight. We'll pass it out. Maybe you could go find it, actually. It's in one of those suitcases. Oh, it's in the backpack. And it's... there's two different readings there. It's not the one from the Diamond Sutra. It's the other one. and they all sit around the table and they look at that glass of water. So what happens? You know, what's going on? How does Madhyamika explain that glass of water? And this is the subject of emptiness. This is very, very intimately related to the subject of emptiness. So what does the preta see? Wait, start with the human.
Water.
Yeah, the human sees a nice glass of water. You know, just a normal glass of water. And the preta sees pus and blood, vomit, and glass. What does the la see? By worldly la. Yeah, they call it amrita, nectar. You know, see some wonderful ambrosia, you know, some wonderful, beautiful liquid. You know, so then you get into the whole question of what's really there. You know, what is really there, and that's a very and what's going on when three different beings look at the same object and see three different, completely different things. So, I guess the first question would be: can one object be three things at once? And then they say, they're very careful in the scripture, they say, can this glass of liquid? That's very cool. Can this glass of liquid be blood, water, and ambrosia at the same time? So that's the first question, can it be?
In terms of this being perception.
In the debate, they won't let you. They want yes or no, and that's how you get in trouble. They can be all. I don't. Okay, so let's say yes. Okay, then they say, "So I'll debate you now." it's a tenet of all Buddhist schools that physical matter has a quality of blocking. In other words, you can't fit two physical objects in the same space at the same time. That's a tenet of Buddhism. You know, the nature of a tangible object is that once you, if you have one object there and you push the other one into its space, the first one has to leave. I mean, that's a tenet of Buddhism. That's even the name of physical objects is that something strikeable, you know, blocking. It blocks the presence of the other object. So wouldn't the blood block the presence of the water? This is a big debate in the monastery, you know. How could it be three? Wouldn't the blood, if it were all blood, couldn't that blood block out the water? And if it were water, wouldn't the water block out the ambrosia? And how could you have three different physical objects occupying the same space at the same time? Ha! I mean, that's what they say if you say yes. If you say no, you're getting another problem.
I mean, the argument's a little artificial to begin with. Yeah. They're all perceiving liquid. They're all perceiving liquid in a vacuum.
In a glass.
You kind of met an artificial argument to begin with.
No.
One might see an elephant. One might see a liquid. One might see spiders and scorpions. You're kind of limiting the argument.
Yeah.
What would a Buddha see?
Ultimate ambrosia. You see, a different kind of ambrosia.
I mean, would it fit for what it actually was? Whatever that
was. Oh, now you're in trouble. What is it actually? Now that's a big question. What is it actually? I'll get out of. He gave a pretty good argument, so I'll just skip to you. What is it actually?
I don't know.
Oh, by the way, the scripture says it's interesting, and this is what it says, and you can read it. It's a little complicated. It might, you know, these are monastic textbooks, and they're kind of hard. But it says, insofar as when they're looking at the glass of water, sorry, the glass of liquid, okay? There's three different aspects appearing to each different one. So it's not, it's only a part of the glass of liquid which is appearing as blood, and a part is appearing as ambrosia, and a part is appearing as water. So that's pretty easy. And then they say, if the preta reaches out and takes personal possession of the water and perceives the whole water, it all becomes blood and pus. And they say that's not contradictory, you know, that if he has a unique experience of the glass of liquid, then it is purely and totally pus and blood. And so long as three people are looking at it, three different beings from three different realms, by the way, are looking at it, then it's not contradictory for different aspects of it to be showing to three different people. So you get out of the problem of it being all blood or all water, you know, all ambrosia. What's that?
That's like what the physics of Schrodinger's game.
I don't know about that, but what's that?
Like a photon sometimes acts like a wave and sometimes like a particle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it actually has the potential to be both, and it doesn't become either until it's perceived.
I like it,
the
yeah.
The moment of perception, it actually has to choose. The choice is made by it. But until that happens, it actually has possibility, and if nobody is perceiving it, then it has all the possibilities, and it hasn't actually made the choice yet.
It's exactly emptiness. I mean, that's exactly what Buddhism mm-hmm. says. That's exactly true according to Buddhism. So cool, the physicists are getting there. Okay. So you can't say what is it really, then you get in trouble. Or can you? Is it really water?
It's liquid.
Yeah, I think you have to say that. I think, you know, I kept bugging him that he couldn't do that, but I'll let you do it. Okay. It really is.
That's common.
It really is. Yeah, always. Yeah, it really is water, and it really is blood, and it really is ambrosia, and one object can be all three. And by the way, that's the emptiness of the glass of liquid. You know, it's not one way or the other by itself. It depends on your perceptions, which are, how do you get them? Say it a little better. No, the karma forces you to. Karma forces you to interpret it that way.
Okay.
You don't have a choice. I think that's important to say, because I always thought that, I always somehow thought, and I think a lot of Buddhists think, that if I perceived emptiness directly, then after that I could choose. But it's not true. It's not a voluntary thing. I may get to a point where I truly perceive that the glass of liquid is nothing inherently. It's none of those three inherently. I may reach a point like that. But can I then make it ambrosia by decision?
Yeah, sure.
I can't. Because it's forced on me by other... It's not under my control. If I wanted to be ambrosia, if I really want the glass of water to be, for me, ambrosia in a Buddha paradise, what do I have to do?
Become a Buddha.
Nah, that's too easy. Yeah. And that's the time lag, okay? The classic time lag. You might as well know, okay? It's the classic time lag. I mean, there's nothing... You may perceive emptiness this afternoon, but it's not going to help you because you still have all those bok chunks. I mean, of course it helps you, but it's not going to change the world at that moment because you have all those old bok chunks that are dictating how you see things. In other words, because things are empty... Then being good has some meaning, and we'll talk more about that. But it's only because they're empty that being good has any point to it. Because they have the potential to be anything, because they are nothing until your karma forces you to see them one way or the other. It becomes very important to be
good.
Ethical, good. You know, it becomes extremely important because that's the only way that water is going to turn to ambrosia for you. you can't. That's not it's not a question of deciding that it's going to be ambrosia. It's a question of what your karma is dictating to you, whether you want it or not. So the only way to get it to turn into ambrosia is to be ethical, is to be good.
Decide that it's eventually going to be ambrosia.
That's the only way it ever will be. You had a question.
If perception is such an increased thing, then does it really matter what's there in the glass?
Say again?
No, if perception is the all important thing, what does it matter what's in the glass then? I mean,
what is in the glass?
Yeah,
it's
what's
that? It's that our goal. And the goal of every living creature is to be happy. This is a classic question, and the question is this. I'm looking at him again, okay? And the question is, if I stop focusing on the person, on the image in my mind, and now I start focusing on the sense data, the colors, the shapes, this relative shading or not, the shadows or non-shadows, if I start focusing on them, are they reality?
Yes, it is reality.
Are they fixed? Okay, I admit that my image of you as a human or as a mountain of threatening stuff is dependent upon my karma, my projections, right, forced on me by my past karma. But what about the data, the very data on which I base my projections? The liquid. Let's stop talking about blood, water, or ambrosia and start talking about the wet stuff. Okay? Is there really wet stuff there? Now I'm shifting levels, right? Here's the level of looking at water, and now I'm looking at the wetness. In Buddhism, it's called wetness and flowing. Lenshin Sherwa Chui Tini. Definition of the element of water is that which is wet and flowing. Okay, so now I shift my focus. I go from the water, and I start focusing on the sense data. The wetness and the flowing. Is that inherently existent? You know? Is that something which is really there, independent of my projections? Well, the minute I move my focus down to that, it's again a projection. Okay? Tani tabe chu manyi. It means it's a very beautiful proof of emptiness. You can keep going down levels. Okay, what about the left side of the water? What about the bottom of the left side of the water? What about the right side of the bottom of the left side of the water? And you can keep going down, down, down into deeper levels, component parts. But each time you shift levels, you get into projection. You will never find the thing. You know, that's when lamas get up and start talking about you. You know, where is you? Which used to confuse me a lot. You know, I'm right here. You know, yeah, my projection of me is right here. That's okay. And that, by the way, that operates. It functions. That's the big thing about Nagarjuna. You know, it still works. Didn't say it's artificial, but it works. And you can suffer, or you can have pleasure, or you can be in paradise, or you can be in samsara. But that's because the projections are real. They make your reality, and you can't get out of them by choosing. They're forced on you. So every time you change levels, it's again a projection, you see. And if you look for something fixed that's not a projection, you'll never find it. And that's one of the proofs for emptiness.
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't that water have any properties dependent on your projection?
No, that's the whole point. The minute you start looking at the properties, that's another projection based on their properties.
So that is something static. Water is static. So would that mean to say it has no real existence outside of our projection?
Right, exactly.
No, but since he's,
does that make it unreal? Does that mean you can't drown in it? No. And that's a very important point. Very few people get to the first question you had. Even fewer people get to the realization you can still drown in it. You know.
Okay, let's say, for example, I were to see a glass of water in this room. I would say it's going to be a projection, and I walk out of the room, would that projection disappear? The glass of water is still going to be there, right?
Mm-hmm.
For you.
As you think of it, it's there. It's there. If there were no one to... By the way, when they give the definition of the existence as Semi Mikpa, this used to worry me, okay? Semi Mikpa Yubetini. Definition of existence is that which is perceived by a valid perception. Okay, so I used to ask my Lama, what about the tree in the forest? That's your question. When you go out of the room, what happens to the water? Does it cease to exist? You know, in the Kadampa Center in the basement of this building, we all go home tonight. Does that glass of water disappear until tomorrow morning? Or where does it go? You know, is there any... If there's no longer any pramana, which is perceiving that glass of water, then does it fail to exist if the definition of existence is that which is perceived by a pramana? And they say, well, unfortunately, there's this omniscient being. You see? There's never a tree in the forest. According to Buddhism,
a Buddha is omniscient. So a Buddha's consciousness would always be validly perceiving that water.
Amnesia? His all knowingness. He knows everything. So, in one moment, a Buddha is perceiving every object that exists. So it's established by the Tsema or the Pramana or the valid perception of a Buddha. And even, by the way, by your thinking of the water. You know, if you go home tonight and you still have any memory or awareness of the water, and that changes per school, the water's still there. You can still say it exists there.
So it is possible that there is a physical reality outside of the mental reality?
No, really not. If all of us stopped having the karma imposed on us to see that water, the glass would break and the water would flow out and dry up.
Isn't part when we're in the room and we see the water, it doesn't exist the way we think it exists right there.
Oh yeah.
Much less when we go out of the room, we say, does it still have that existence that is false?
Yeah.
Yeah, so
yeah, is it anything other than a projection forced on you by karma? No. So that's the idea of the glass of water. And that's the idea that one object can be really three different objects for those three different people. And there's no contradiction for that. And in fact, that's the way things are. And that's why you're having the experiences that you have right now. That's what the glass of water, it's very famous in Madhyamika, the example of the glass of water and how three different people can perceive it as three different things. Does it apply to a person at your office who is not very pleasant? You know, like all of us have this person at the office that we don't get along with. I don't know if you're a normal person, okay? I have. You know, it depends on how big your office is maybe, but they say that... You know, I think almost everybody has some person in their life that really pushes your buttons, you know. And just every time you meet them, they push your buttons. And it's just something about this person that when you meet them, it just doesn't click and things go wrong and you feel bad and they seem to be hurting you or bad to you. Do other people see the person in the same way? Some.
It won't be exactly.
In fact, every additional person that sees them that way is good because you feel confirmed, you know. You feel like he really is bad, you know. And you strive to get other people to see it your way, you know. You'd rather have other people dislike him and agree with you than like him. Because then you would be convinced that you were right and this really is a bad person. So, when the person's bad to you, is it just your perception, or are they really being bad to you? Is it just your perception, or are they really being bad to you? It's a quick trick question, okay? It is your perception, so they are being bad to you. Really? Really, you know? It's very interesting. They are being, I don't mean to say, and that's another thing about this particular lesson, is that there's things called attitude changes, you know, where you go to your psychologist and they say, go to work and try to think of the person as your father, or someone you love, and then maybe you'll be able to overcome your dislike from them. In fact, Shantideva says that, you know, for for a certain case. Shantideva, except till you get to the last chapter, is full of these little psychological tricks of, if you can't control yourself and you don't understand emptiness, well, you better use these temporary patches called lojong. And go and do anything to trick yourself out of being bad, because you get collecting all those megabytes and stuff, you know. Even if you don't, even if it's the only, Nagarjuna gets into it in his letter to the king. The first half of the book is how to prevent yourself from collecting bad karma. And in the case of a monk with a lady, for example, try to think of her as your sister and don't have desire. Or try to think of her as your mother. Or try to imagine the poop coming out of her rear end or anything to make it. They go through this whole thing of try to focus on the bad parts and the ugly parts, and then you won't have desire for this object. And then, or try to conceive of the person as being a close relative with whom you'd never have that kind of desire. And then suddenly Nagarjuna stops and says, but that's not going to really help. You have to understand the emptiness of this person, you know. And then the whole rest of the book is about emptiness. And it's very beautiful, you know. So really, what's the definition of nirvana? Do you know? It's called Nyundip Malupar Pangbe Sosur Tango. Say Nyundip Malupar Pangbe Sosur Tango. Nyundip Malupar Pangbe Sosur Tango. Nyundip means the bad thoughts, kleshas, bad thoughts in your mind, mental afflictions, and all of the spiritual blockages that are caused by them. So nyundip means that. Basically all the mental afflictions, anger, jealousy, hatred, desire, all of those things. Malupar means in their entirety. Pangbe means you got rid of them. Sosor tangok means a state of being rid of them, which is caused by sosor tokpa. Sosor tokpa is, it's a very weird word, and it means individually realize. So, you know, everyone's trying to figure out what individually, because that's important. This is the definition of nirvana. Nirvana is getting rid of all of your bad thoughts through the method of sosor tok. So what is sosor tok? Sosor means one by one. Tokpa means to understand. But it all refers to the path of seeing. It all refers to the perception of emptiness directly. So we got about like 20 minutes left, and then I think we should quit. But I'd like to talk about, we've talked about emptiness from a logical point of view. Now, what about from an experiential point of view? Okay. Then you get into the teaching of the five paths. There are five paths in Buddhism, five spiritual levels that you go through. The definition of path in Buddhism is Dokpa. It means realizations. So path in Buddhism in this sense means not what it means in Lam Rim, for example, the steps of the path. Steps of the path means first do this, then do that, then do that, then do that. And it's like a path of action. But five paths means five spiritual levels. Say, Tsok, Jor, Tong, Gom, Milop. One more time. Tsok, Jor, Tong, Gom, Milop. Okay. Tsoglam, first path of accumulation, okay, path of collection. But what it is you achieve this when you are able to develop true disgust with this condition of this life. You know, and that's a big threshold to get over. It's extremely rare that a person truly gets fed up with the condition that every nice thing turns sour. I mean, when your wife dies or you get in a car accident, most of the good Buddhists I know had some disaster in their life, you know. It takes a very major event to make you admit the way things are. And that's that any good thing you have in your life is going to be lost. It's going to turn bad. And you might as well admit it now and do something about it. Or you can go on kidding yourself, you know. So that's the stage of renunciation. If you get to that point, and it's not a big spiritual, you know, you don't have to be a great thinker to see that things go bad. I mean, read the obituaries, you know, I mean, you know, or, you know, every famous person you ever know, every handsome movie star, every strong athlete, you know, every intelligent thinker, they lose it. You always lose it. So you can either wait till it happens or you can do something about it before it happens. And that's renunciation. And it's not like being negative. You can still enjoy ice cream, and I do, and stuff like that. It doesn't mean you can't enjoy things, you know. You enjoy the nice things. But you have to find a way that they're not fattening, you know. What I mean is, you have to find a way to find the ice cream that doesn't make you suffer ultimately. You know, you have to find a way to find pleasures that don't turn bad. You know, that's the whole purpose. You have to find this method. So it's not a big thing to say life is bad. It's not. It doesn't require thinking of something that you didn't think of yet, or trying to make it something that it's not. It really is, you know. And you don't have to be a big genius, and you don't have to be depressed about it. But you just see it for what it is, and you don't go running after things that are going to turn bad on you. You go for the big things. Go for big pleasures. Hasakya Pandita said, "Deva chuna chapa deva chambotomisi." If you get attached to small pleasures like ice cream, you'll never reach high pleasures like nirvana. You know, I mean, you have to make a choice sometimes. And it doesn't mean you have to deny the pleasures of this life. Enjoy them. I mean, I don't see the Dalai Lama being grumpy and depressed, and, you know, he's one man who knows how to enjoy ice cream, probably, you know, I mean, he really does, and he takes enjoyment out of things. Enjoy the good things, but find a way that they're not going to turn bad. You know, try to find nirvana. So the first path is renunciation, when you get true renunciation. And it's not a big deal, just admit the way things are. It's not a leap of faith to pretend that something's there that's not there. That's the way it really is. Just admit it. And stop running after things that aren't going to make you happy. You know? But enjoy them. But don't spend your time trying to get them. But they will come. It's a byproduct. Joylam is the path of preparation. Second path. It means path of preparation. You are preparing for what? Do you guess? Preparing for the perception of emptiness on the third path. Okay. But second path is path of preparation. It is marked by intellectual understandings of emptiness. There are four stages in it. And during this period, you are getting warm. In fact, one of them is called getting warm. You know, you're getting hot. You're getting close, you know. And you start having all these understandings about emptiness. It's a direct result of being taught properly emptiness. It's a direct result of someone taking the authentic scriptures and teaching you properly what emptiness is. From the, you know, Nagarjuna and Tsongkhapa, and from the real people who knew. It's a direct result of classroom hours. And then contemplating those things. So during that path, you start to have intellectual understandings of emptiness. In the last moments of that path, which are called peak, it's called peak, you have a direct perception of relative reality. It's very interesting. Not ultimate reality, which happens shortly afterwards, but at the highest stages of the path of preparation, you truly perceive what you are doing about imaging those data. You see, right? You understood it when I explained it to you. But at that stage in the path of preparation, you will actually catch yourself doing it. And you will see that there isn't any guy out there. There's colors and shapes. And I'm perfecting some kind of image in my mind. And what I'm watching when I look at him is an image. I'm not looking at him. I'm looking at an image. I'm looking at a mental image. I'm not looking at him. And that is what they call relative truth or relative reality. Or dependent origination, if you will. Same thing. Okay? You catch yourself doing it. You know that you see yourself doing it. And then you finally understand that you never saw a guy. Ever. All these years you thought you were seeing these things and you weren't. And I can explain it and you can understand it from my words, but when it happens, it's a different thing. When you actually perceive it directly. You go into meditation Somebody asked me about shamatha shine, right? You go into meditation, you must have been very good at meditating. You must have practiced it for years. You must have done it like at least an hour and a half a day. Deep meditation. And your mind goes into a different level. We are in a level called the desire realm. And in that state of meditation, your mind goes into what's called the form realm. It's the next realm up. And it's the first part of the form realm. And it's the introductory part of the first part of the form realm. Your mind must be and will be on that day in that particular level. Your body is still in the desire realm. And based on that level, based on that state of concentration or meditation, you can see emptiness directly. And only on that level. Your mind has to be capable of reaching that level. Which is a totally different question. That's the whole question of learning to meditate properly. It's just getting to that level, because you can't see emptiness directly unless you're at that level. So, and that's that you have to perfect shamatha. You have to know how to get into shamatha to get to that level, and only at that level can you perceive emptiness directly. And then you perceive emptiness directly. And it can last for like 15 minutes. And you're not aware of any relative object, because this is a direct perception of ultimate reality. So you cannot perceive a relative object. So do you think to yourself, I did it? Yes or no? No, I'm a relative object. I, my colors, my shapes, my mind, my body, those are all relative objects. They require imaging to see. You can't even see it. So how could you say, I'm perceiving emptiness, finally I did it, you know? You cannot have that perception at that moment. You cannot even have any perception, obviously no sense perceptions, but no other mental perceptions. You can't have any other mental perceptions. It's pure, direct perception of ultimate reality. And it lasts maybe 15, 20 minutes. And then you come down out of that. And then there's a whole story, and we'll talk about that. And maybe I'll save it for tomorrow. Then you perceive the Four Noble Truths directly. The word noble is a mistake of translation. What is it in Sanskrit? No, it's Arya. Okay, it's Arya. Arya, you know, Hitler misused it. Forget that one. And it's not the tribe of people who came to India, although it probably means it kind of came from that. But Arya means superior, or special, or elite. Elite's not bad. Elite in the sense of you are now one of the people who has seen emptiness directly. Okay, there's only two kinds of beings in the universe. I compare it, and I'm sorry if it's a bad comparison, but you're either a virgin or you're not a virgin. Okay, and you can think of your life as one long stream of time. And I like the thing of virginity, because after that you're never the same. I mean, and you know, there's a point in your life where you lost it, and after that you're never the same. You're either one or the other. Every being on the planet, every human, is one or the other. And at some point in their life they changed. And forever after they were different. Perceiving emptiness is exactly the same. Perceiving emptiness directly. There's only two kinds of beings in the universe. They're either the elite or they're not the elite. They're either Aryas or they're not Aryas. And there's that big division and it's the most basic and important division of all living creatures. You're either an Arya or you're not. You've either seen emptiness directly or you haven't seen emptiness directly. And just after you see it directly and you come down out of that meditation, your mind is back in the desire realm, then you perceive the Four Noble Truths, which are really the four... Arya truth. They're the four Arya truths. The noble is a bad translation of the word Arya, Pakpa. And it means a person who's seen emptiness directly. Why do they call them Arya truths? Because right after you come out of that perception of emptiness directly, you perceive those four things directly. And the four aspects of the four things directly. 16 total. You perceive them directly. You perceive the truth, those four truths, those four facts directly. And they're confirmed by the knowledge of a person who's just seen emptiness directly. So they are right on. They are absolutely true. Because they are something which is being understood by a person who has just come out of the direct perception of emptiness. You see those four truths one by one, and that's sosor. Sosor tokpa. So we go back to the definition of nirvana. We just did a big circle, okay? That's to see those four truths one by one after seeing emptiness directly is part of the definition of nirvana. The definition of nirvana was was getting rid of your mental afflictions by way of having seen emptiness directly. And that's the only way you can get rid of your mental afflictions. It's the only way you can ever get rid of your mental... All the Lobjong texts, the mental training texts, are band-aids. Until they get to that part. You know, all this thing about trying to think of the guy at work, your enemy as your friend, and trying to think about how much they can... Your enemy is your enemy. In the sense that they hurt you, they want to hurt you, they're trying to hurt you. You know, I mean, from that point of view, an enemy is an enemy. You know, you can try to think that when they hurt you, they're teaching you something. But what is his intent? What is he out to do? I mean, it's absolutely to harm you. He wants to hurt you. You can try to imagine it, you can try to conceive of it as something else and benefit from that. But the reality is that the enemy is hurting you. They are hurting you. What do you do when they hurt you? That's the big question. You can only know what to do when you see emptiness directly. I mean, you have to see emptiness directly, and then you will truly know what to do with this person who tries to, who's intent on hurting you, who fits the definition of an enemy. And that's why it's really you have to understand emptiness to do the right thing, to behave properly. You have to understand emptiness. We'll talk more about that tomorrow. But basically, the definition of nirvana is getting rid of your bad thoughts permanently because you have seen emptiness directly. That's the only way you can. And so if you're interested in getting rid of your... Think of how it would be not to have any bad thought for the rest of your life. You know, I mean, I wish I could do that. It would be interesting. You know, no more jealousy, no more anger, never irritated with anyone. Only happy, only loving, only sharing. You know, you're incapable of a bad thought. I mean, and that's, by the way, the fourth path, okay? So I better finish the five path. And then we'll go. That's called Gomlam. Gomlam means path of... that word gom can either mean meditation or habituation. Third one was the path of seeing. I'm sorry. We did it, but we didn't name it. Okay. Tonglam, path of seeing. What do you see? Directly. You must add the word directly. Big difference between seeing it intellectually, which happens on path number two, and seeing it directly, which happens on path number three. Big difference. So third one is path of seeing. Fourth one is path of habituation. Some people call it path of meditation, but habituation means the whole process of the years and years it takes to put what you experienced into practice and use it to collect good karma, you know, to use it to learn to be pure. And that can take seven lifetimes. I mean, very typical is seven lifetimes. and that's a long time. I mean, that takes, it's using your knowledge of emptiness to stop creating bad deeds, you know, to purify yourself. That's path number four. And then path number five is, it's called the path of no more learning. Miloplam. And if you don't have bodhicitta, if you don't have the desire to achieve Buddhahood for all living beings, when you reach path number five, that's nirvana. That is nirvana. You eliminate permanently your mental afflictions. So could you achieve nirvana this afternoon and still come tomorrow and look like the same person? Yeah. It's a mental thing. It's not a physical thing. It's just removing your mental affliction. You could have achieved it centuries ago. I wouldn't know. Unless I could read your mind, I can't know. You know, if you achieved it tonight and came here tomorrow, you'd still look the same, most likely. So, It's just the permanent removal of your bad thoughts. That's the definition of nirvana. If you do have bodhicitta, if under the influence of bodhicitta you reach that same state, you become a fully enlightened Buddha. You are a Buddha. So miloblam, path number 5 for a person on the Mahayana track, is Buddhahood. Total Buddhahood. Path number one, by the way, just for you, you people who care, path number one for Mahayana track is reaching bodhicitta, the true desire to reach enlightenment for other people. It's not just getting fed up with life. And the lamas explain it as meaning getting fed up of life for other people as well as yourself. That's bodhicitta. So it's not contradictory. It's the same thing. Okay, so that's... We'll talk more tomorrow about the path of seeing. I mean, experiential part of it. You know, we'll go on with that. And why it ties in with karma and ethical living. And then finally, if there's anything you can do to clean up the the old bok choks that are hanging around in your mind, wherever they are, right? Anybody have any questions or anything like that?
It just strikes me that it would certainly be a mistake if you try to force yourself to not think certain things, bad thoughts or whatever, that you could spend a lot of time trying to force those things out of your awareness, but instead that you would want to just really search for understanding, search for knowledge, search to because then they would disappear as a result of the awareness rather than the effort of will.
No, I think that's why you... That's why only perceiving emptiness can remove them permanently. Because basically, if you constantly contemplated this process by which your own bad karmas create your reality, then you would never want to do anything bad. I mean, if you really understood what we said today, what we talked about today, the last thing you'd want to do is do any kind of bad deed. You know, I mean, that's the whole point. You see, that's why I started out saying, you know, when I was first starting in Buddhism, I couldn't see the connection. You know, what's emptiness? How am I going to change tomorrow if I see emptiness? You know, how does emptiness help me be a good person? Well, if you understand how the projections of karma need emptiness to operate, quite the opposite. You'd avoid it like the plague. You know, you would never, ever want it. The minute it started, you would run away from it. You know, and there's two ways of running away. I mean, one is understanding and overcoming. And the other is what's called concentric circle theory in Buddhist monks' vows. We have concentric circle theory. And that's, you can say the middle circle is breaking your vow of celibacy. The second circle is ever kissing a lady. The third circle is ever being alone in a room with a lady to kiss her. The fourth circle is ever entering a house where there's a lady who's not accompanied by someone else. The fifth circle is ever going out of your monastery, you know. So if you never go past the first circle, you never get to the middle point where you break your vow. So for what it means for you about bad karma or from a normal person, it means if you don't have a strong enough understanding yet, Prajnaparamita, if you don't have the perfection of wisdom perfected yet, avoid the circumstances, you know. If you know that you get bad when you get tired, then don't get tired. You know, avoid getting tired. You know, if you know that you lose your temper when you're overworked, for God's sake, you know, at any cost, avoid being overworked. You know, it's better to be poor and underworked than to engage in overwork, which you know is going to make you have a bad karma. You know, this is the concentric circle theory. You know, if you are vulnerable to certain bad deeds under certain conditions, then avoid those conditions at all costs. You know, don't let yourself get close to those conditions, because once the bok chak is planted, it's really hard to get it out. You don't want to wait that long. It's like the oak tree on the top of the temple. You know, it's better to throw that. Seriously, much easier to throw the acorn out in the street. You know, really.
In some ways, it would make sense to force bad thoughts or force behaviors because you're not there yet where you understand.
That's what I'm saying, yeah. And that's why the first 5 chapters of Shantideva or anybody else is okay. Here's how to be patient if you don't understand emptiness. you know, try to understand that it raises your blood pressure, and you know, I mean, and try to.
Could you say something? Several people have expressed an interest in Buddhist refuge. Mm-hmm. Just say a little bit about that. This is a good time.
It's a great time. I mean, and I will stop at 5, so don't worry.
Session 1 continues on the next CD.